Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
Well, it's 2024, and it's also the return of the Jackpod. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and yes, I can hear you cheering and clapping out there in podcast land because the Jackpod is indeed back. And it's where On Point news analyst Jack Beattie helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack, and Happy New Year to you.
Hello, and a very happy new year to you, Meghna.
I'm so delighted to be back here with you, Jack. So let's get right to it. Episode 16 of the pod today, our first of 2024. What's your headline for kicking this year off?
Democracy and its discontents.
Oh, wow. Wasting no time, Jack, to get to the heart of the issue here. So what are the specific discontents that you want to look at today?
Well, they're not the discontent that many Americans feel with the likely rematch between Biden and Trump. Dave Barry, the humorist, has well said that most Americans look forward to that rematch with all the enthusiasm with which they would regard a colonoscopy at Jiffy Lube.
Oh, dear.
I'm talking about the evidence, the suggestive evidence that many people are just they haven't done well enough in this democracy, and they're frustrated with the system. You know, we tend to think, who couldn't like democracy? And yet it has frustrations that are perhaps unique to it. And one of them was really well stated by Theodore Adorno in his classic, The Authoritarian Personality. And This is really a sketch of political psychology rather than the support of an authoritarian regime. So he's talking about what people feel rather than what they will vote for. But, of course, one would lead to the other. Anyway, here's his take on what's hard about living in a democracy. It cannot be disputed that formal democracy under the present economic system does not suffice to guarantee to the bulk of the population satisfaction of the most elementary wants and needs. Whereas, at the same time, the democratic form of government is presented as if it were close to an ideal society. He goes on, the resentment caused by this contradiction is turned by those who do not see the economic roots. It's turned by those against the form of democracy itself because it does not fulfill what it promises.
Mm. Wow.
When you marry democracy with competitive free market capitalism, people are going to say, this is the greatest system on earth. Why aren't I flourishing?
Yeah.
Why are things so bad? And I think he puts his finger right on it.
Simply jump in here. That was from 1950, you said?
Yes.
Okay. What evidence do you see now that people may be increasingly willing to ditch democracy?
Well, there are two groups in the society that we can, that evidence suggests are, let's put it this way, their ties to belief in democracy weakening. One, white working class voters, and the other, and surprisingly, younger voters. You know, it's a cliche to say that white working class voters are restive and unhappy. But when you start to look at the headlines of articles and papers about them, it really brings that home. You know, the unhappy outlook of the U.S. white working class, the lonely poverty of the U.S. working class. Who's to blame for the plight of the white working class? Economic Fatalism and the American White Working Class. On and on, this picture of, and we know the statistics, we've seen them, of life just not satisfying Americans without a college degree. And the Federal Reserve in St. Louis did a study of this, and there's a key sentence that brings out the plight of these people and also the resentment that comes from that. The sentence is, we conjecture that the white working class and its problems may be due to the reduction over time of advantages its members once had over non-white families with no college degree. In other words, white working class voters are looking out on a situation where, in fact, among African Americans, marriage rates are increasing. Among Hispanics, they are stable as always. Among white working class voters, they are declining. That's just one of the indices that is disturbing on this economic front, but also one rife with racial resentment. And, you know, to the problem of, you know, not having enough, there's added the rebuffs to dignity that are the lot of people without a college degree in this society. And here's an anecdote. A friend of mine once applied to be an accountant at a milk company in Boston. And they gave him a big test. And one of the things in the test was they had to pronounce a bunch of words. You know, someone said, pronounce these words. And he pronounced them, and he looked at one, and he said, goth. And the person said, yes, and he said, goth. And he didn't get the job, and he thought, you know, the reason I didn't get that job, I had never heard, he was from a Connecticut mill town, I had never heard anybody say the word Goethe.
Oh.
For want of Goethe, he couldn't get the job. That's the kind of indignity that the college educated, quote unquote, the college educated Americans tend to foist upon those with less opportunity.
You know, Jack, just to underscore the point you made that links it back to racial resentment, of course, any person of color listening to this would say that, you know, especially Black Americans, they've always had to feel careful about how they speak, right, in certain situations, because of the automatic judgments that are made just simply based on accent and dialect. And so to the fact that your story and more importantly, working class white Americans now may be feeling those same indignities, the ideal situation to come out of that would be a sense of economic solidarity then with other groups of Americans who have long felt those same indignities. But because of that racial resentment, that's not what we're getting out of this, at least as far as I can tell.
No, we're not. And it's being partly because no one is speaking to it. And someone is speaking to the opposite, you know, to sort of polarize. And that, of course, is Donald Trump, who has found this vein of resentment and has worked it and is working it now in regard to immigrants and others in the society. In general, saying it's those people who are, behind your troubles, not the economic system.
So no one but Trump speaking to it. We're going to come back to that in a minute, Jack, because I think that's such an important point. But you also mentioned in terms of being increasingly dubious about democracy, you mentioned young Americans.
Yes, this is quite frightening when you look at the evidence. Our friend Yaksha, is that how you say his name?
Yaksha.
I don't want to be
Yaksha Mook.
Yaksha,
yeah.
I beg your pardon. He's been on the show several times. He did a fascinating study that's been much quoted, I think about 5 years ago. And what he found was that among young Americans, support for democracy is waning. You know, to the sentence, it is essential to live in a democracy. 72% of older Americans, yes, only 30% of young people. Among young Americans polled in 2011, a record high of 24% said democracy is a bad or very bad way to run the country. Army rule, well, rule by the army in 1995, as recently as that, only 1 in 16 young persons said that. Now, it's 1 in 6.
Wow.
So there is a great deal of unhappiness that young Americans feel in the first instance at the economic system and the lot they have in life, but it's being refracted and directed toward democracy. And when you say, what's their economic situation? Nothing brings it home more than this finding. Among Americans born like Joe Biden, during or just after World War II, we had a 90% chance of earning more than our parents, 90%. Among people born after 1980, only 50% of those young Americans have done better or can be expected to do better than their parents. That is a dramatic decline in absolute mobility. And it's fastened on young Americans, assailed by the, burdened by the cost of housing and all the, and the student loans and everything they've had to sacrifice to get where they are. And where are they? They're not in a place that they're happy about. And they are not happy with, many of them, with the system.
Okay, Jack, so that was quite eye-opening about why a lot of young people are discontented with democracy. So we got to take a quick break here, but when we come back, Jack, I want to take a look at with you about what that means for 2024. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
Well, we're back, and Jack, I'm still thinking about those eye-popping statistics that you had from Yasha Munk about how the sharp decline in social and economic mobility for young Americans these days in comparison to previous generations. I mean, that's like a real-time crumbling that we're watching, a crumbling of the bedrock of one of, the American ideals that you can always raise yourself up in life. And you also said that no one's really speaking about this, maybe except for Trump, to people. And that, first of all, Jack, do you really think that no one's thinking about this? You don't think Biden is speaking about this? And if not, I mean, that could pose a major problem for him in the election that's coming up later this year.
Well, he's saying the issue of the election is, will you keep democracy or not? I think he's right. You know, Trump is going to introduce some sort of, he said it himself, dictatorship, something that will not bear any resemblance to what we have known as American democracy. So he's right that that's the issue of the election. But I have not heard him address these frustrations that are threatening to bring down democracy. Indeed, in terms of the young people, in the current New York Review, Fintan O'Toole has an essay. He says, Biden is a lightning rod for the kind of generational inequality we just talked about. The people in his generation, almost all of them did better than their parents. People since 1980 struggle to even stay near their parents. And Biden, he says, is a lightning rod for that inequality. He says many young Americans identify him with the age-related injustices that have shaped their lives. And Biden, rather than seeming alive to this threat to him, has a almost has expressed callous sentiments, let's put it this way, about young people's plight. Here he is in 2018 talking to the LA Times. The younger generation now tells me how tough things are. Give me a break. No, I have no empathy for it. Give me a break. Because here's the deal, guys. We decided we were going to change the world, and we did. He's saying we boomers are the ones who, you don't even talk to us. We made this America. This is our land, not yours. An incredible statement from a presidential candidate about, you know, the problems that that young people face. And O'Toole, in the New York Review, he says, being the old white man brings Biden no rewards, only resentment. And he adds, and resentment is the medium in which Donald Trump thrives. Indeed, Biden, who carried young people by 24 points in 2020, he now trails Trump among them by 7 points.
Wow. If there's ever been a time to say completely non-ironically, okay, boomer, I mean, I feel like this is it, Jack. Right? But when you dug up that quote from Biden in the LA Times, you said 2018?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Because when he says, we decided, well, actually it was the U.S. government that decided in the post-war era to significantly, you know, sort of follow on the heels of both the New Deal and what happened in the Second World War to invest in people here. So, I mean, who's the we? The we is the government. Now, he is the president.
Yes. And, you know, in his defense, Jim Clyburn was on the television over the weekend, and he says, you know, he's forgiven something like $3 million in student loans for something like 3 million young Americans. He's tried to do more on that score. He was rebuffed by the courts. He's going to come back and try it. And he named other things that Biden has done for young people. But this kind of attitude, this sort of generational triumphalism he seems to feel, is really missing the point. I mean, the boomers are not as big as we used to be, but we control everything, the commanding heights, and the gerontocracy that has fastened on American politics is, well, it's a boomer gerontocracy.
And for the record, I am not a boomer. I'm one of those disaffected Gen Xers, but, you know, speaking stereotypically. But so, Jack, this all comes together then. I hear you going in a certain direction. That, first of all, I'm glad that you mentioned that all the responsibility cannot be simply hung on the office of the presidency, because we do have three technically co-equal branches of government. And there has been enormous obstinance from the Republican Party in terms of making permanent many of the ideas and changes that got a little, chance to raise their heads up above the parapet in the COVID era, you know, the Biden rebuilding plans. So it would have helped if Congress were able to do things. But more importantly, in an election year, It seems to me politically unwise to constantly point to the things that you tried but were unable to do, right? Instead of offering a new empathetic vision that understands, as you said, the plight of these two groups of Americans in particular and says, here's what we, you know, we can do. Here's what we specifically want to do to help you live a better life. In the absence of that, what do you hear coming from the Trump camp?
Well, the Trump camp just panders to the resentment, you know, to say, if you're not doing well, it's their fault. It's the immigrants. They're poisoning the blood of the country. It's African Americans who get all the breaks. And of course, polls among white working class voters actually show they believe that the government favors African Americans over them. That they're doing worse than African Americans. They are not. Mm-hmm. But that's the self-pity, the victimization that Trump encourages. He thrives. You know, you never would have thought that making a virtue out of being a loser would be so great a talisman to victory. It turns out it is. You have been screwed. You are a loser. I am going to make you a winner and all that. Mm-hmm. And Trump has found that vein. Now, it's open to other people to do things to try to ameliorate that problem. You know, the governor of Pennsylvania, Governor Shapiro, looking at the issue of the people without college degrees, he looked at the employment, the workforce of the state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and he said, look, for 65,000 jobs, we're going to do away with the requirement for a college degree. Hmm. You know, never mind if you can't say Goethe. You can work, fixing the roads. You can work helping people get their benefits. You can do all kinds of things. That's the kind of targeted amelioration, remedy that could help to make white working class voters feel less restive with the democracy itself.
Right. I'm thinking to myself that people who are feeling discontented with democracy, it's not baked in the cake that they will run in the direction of fascism or dictatorship. The other forms of democracy may actually be, you know, more appealing. For example, you know, the programs you were just talking about, or more broadly, European-style social democracies, which are still democracies. But the question, Jack, or a question that you're raising in my mind is, can that happen for as long as we're not hearing the kind of language that you're saying is coming from Joe Biden? And simultaneously, we're hearing very pro-fascism, I'd say, pro-dictatorship language from some of the leading lights in the Republican Party. I mean, you wanted to point out something that Congresswoman Elise Stefanik had recently said.
Oh, yes. This was on Sunday on Meet the Press. And she was, can we have the tape? Can we go to the tape?
Yep. So here is Congresswoman Elise Stefanik. She was interviewed by Kristen Welker, as Jack said, on NBC's Meet the Press.
You mentioned Pennsylvania. Would you vote to certify, and will you vote to certify, the results of the 2024 election, no matter what they show?
Well, I voted not to certify the state of Pennsylvania because, as we saw in Pennsylvania and other states across the country, that there was unconstitutional acts circumventing the state legislature and unilaterally changing election law.
What about 2024? What about 2024?
We will see if this is a legal and valid election. What we're seeing so far is that Democrats are so desperate, they're trying to remove President Trump from the ballot.
Okay, Jack, thoughts?
We'll see about 2024. She's putting us on, she's the third ranking Republican in the House, by the way, and she's strenuously rehearsing for the vice presidential slot under as a candidacy under Trump. She is putting us on notice. The 2024 election will decide nothing unless Donald Trump wins.
I don't even know how to follow that up, Jack. It's a chilling possibility. So is that why you say that American democracy is at stake in 2024?
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly. And people say, you know, Biden shouldn't make it an issue. People are worried about the price of eggs. Yes, they are. Yes, they are. But you know, they've got to be, it's got to be brought home to them, how what how much of what they regard as the goodness and the sweetness of life is connected to self-rule and to the rule of law and to civility and to all the things that Trump means to tear up.
Mm. It reminds me of the Churchillian quote, which I know I'll probably mangle right now, but that democracy is a terrible system of government, except for all the other ones, right?
Right. Yes.
I'm not meaning to make light of the situation, but it's worthy of reminding ourselves that. Well, Jack Potters, I just came up with that new nickname for you. Jack Potters, listening, would love to hear from you on what you think about what Jack has outlined for us today, especially if you are feeling some discontent with American democracy right now. So send us your thoughts. Do it through the On Point Vox Pop app. If you don't already have it, go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop. And let us know, why are you feeling discontented with American democracy or American-style democracy, which is so closely wedded with American capitalism? And let us know if either of the leading candidates for president right now are speaking to you in a way that makes you think there is hope to relieve your discontent. Again, do that through the On Point Vox Pop app. Well, Jack, this was quite a way to get to the podcast for 2024 started. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say for next week, okay?
I'm looking forward to it, too. Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and that's Jack Beatty, and this is On Point's Jackpot. We'll see you all next week.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.